Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for joining us, and welcome back. Today we will explore astronomy at the highest energy. Previously, we had Dr. Jonathan Romney with us, and we discussed radio astronomy. And we learned what astronomers can discover by studying electromagnetic radiation at its lowest energy, longest wavelength end of the spectrum, using the world's largest telescopes. Today we'll shift to the opposite end of the spectrum and talk about detecting the highest energy forms of electromagnetic radiation, namely gamma rays. While you're listening to our show, you'll probably want to check out the images that go with it that are posted on our website. Leave open the window that's providing this audio track and open a second window. There, go to guidetothecosmos.com. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Click on the microphone icon to bring up a menu of radio shows and click on today's show, Gamma Ray Astronomy. When we were talking about radio astronomy, we said that all forms of electromagnetic radiation, whether they are radio waves, microwaves, infrared, visible light, ultraviolet, X-rays, or gamma rays, all forms of electromagnetic radiation are composed of the same types of particles, photons. In fact, these photons are absolutely identical for all forms of electromagnetic radiation, and I refer to all of them as light. The only difference between one photon and another photon is its energy. And that depends as much on our frame of reference as on other things. So for example, if you were to look in a telescope at the red giant star Betelgeuse, you'd see red photons. But if we were to take a telescope and mount it in a rocket and shoot the rocket in the direction of Betelgeuse at, let's say, 90% of the speed of light, those photons that are coming from the same star would appear blue. They are exactly the same photons in both cases. One appears red, one appears blue, and the only difference between them is our frame of reference, meaning our state of motion relative to the source. So energy is not an intrinsic property of a particle. It depends on both the source of the particle and on who's observing it and what their state of motion is. And joining us today to talk about the Fermi gamma ray detector is Dr. Leon Rochester, who was involved in developing the detector itself and is now working on analyzing the data that the satellite is collecting. So Leon graduated from the University of Chicago with a bachelor's degree in physics, and then he went to Caltech, one of my favorite schools, and got his PhD in high energy physics. He was a postdoc for 4 years at the European Center for High Energy Physics Research, which is called CERN, next to Geneva, and then joined the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center in 1973 and has been there ever since. So Leon, how are you today?
I'm fine.
Good, good. So Leon, tell us, why would we want to detect gamma rays?
Sure. Well, the only way we have of looking at astronomical objects is through the radiation that they emit. So talking about stars, this is obviously the first way we ever saw stars was by the light that they put out. And in fact, as techniques developed and as instruments developed, we were able to pretty much figure out what was going on inside of a star, what made them work, just by looking at the light that they produced. We could find the places where there were gaps in the spectrum or enhancements in the spectrum, and that told us what kind of elements were in there, the temperatures and so on. in a similar way, there are a lot of astronomical objects out there that are, unlike stars, where things are more or less under control, are undergoing very violent activity involving the most extreme environments in the universe, extremes of temperature, extremes of magnetic field, of gravity. So the radiation that these objects put out tends to be much higher energy than visible light, and for many of these objects, the most powerful radiation that they emit is in the very high energy gamma ray regime.
Mm-hmm.
So by studying these gamma rays, we hope to be able to understand better what's going on in these extremely violent and extreme regions, such as supernovas, black holes, neutron stars, active galactic nuclei, and so on.
Yeah, all the good stuff. So what is the energy of a gamma ray?
We talk about energies in terms of electron volts. An electron volt is the amount of energy that an electron gets when you put it across a 1-volt battery. The particles, the photons of visible light, have an energy of a few electron volts. The particles that we call gamma rays are those that have an energy starting at a few million times the energy of visible light. And we are measuring gamma rays with energies of a billion or several, even up to several trillion times that of visible light.
And when we discussed in an earlier show radio astronomy, we were talking about photons that had energies that were a million times less than visible light. So astronomy is really covering a remarkably wide spectrum of energies. The heart and soul of this satellite is the gamma ray detector. Image number one that's posted on the website shows a cutout view of this detector, and image number two on the website shows a layout of the detection scheme. So why don't we discuss how a gamma ray detector works and how this is, you know, very different than, for instance, looking at visible light.
Right, okay. So we call our gamma ray detector the Large Area Telescope, or LAT. One of the interesting things about these gamma rays is that they don't penetrate the atmosphere. They're absorbed in the atmosphere, which is why we have to put a satellite out in space to see them. And we, in fact, take advantage of this very property that they're absorbed in matter to detect and measure these gamma rays. Unlike the light that we ordinarily see, these photons come one at a time. So we're actually measuring an elementary particle coming into this detector. And the way we do it is that when a gamma ray passes close to a heavy nucleus, it interacts with that nucleus, the gamma ray gets shaken, and through the magic of quantum mechanics, turns into an electron and an anti-electron, which we call a positron. So from this neutral gamma ray coming into our detector, we produce two charged particles. The detector itself is a sandwich of thin tungsten foils where these pairs of particles will be produced, and silicon wafers with very fine aluminum strips in them, which is where we will detect tracks of these charged particles.
Mm-hmm.
When the electron and positron go through the silicon wafer, they in turn jiggle the silicon, which kicks out some of its electrons. And then these electrons are collected on the very fine aluminum strips. They're about 100 to an inch. And by seeing which strips have current in them, we can tell where the track passed through the silicon wafer. And this is repeated many times. And so what we end up is with a representation of the actual track of the charged particle. And since we now have the track of the electron and the positron, we can put them back together again and infer where that gamma ray came from.
Okay, so when you say there's a sandwich, the purpose of the tungsten foil is to convert the gamma rays into this electron-positron pair.
Right.
And the purpose of the silicon is to detect those electrons and positrons and find out where they're going.
Right.
And so I imagine that every other wafer of silicon is rotated 90 degrees, so in one plane you measure the distance in one dimension, and in the next silicon wafer you measure the distance in the other dimension.
Exactly right.
And how many of these sandwich stacks are there in the detector?
There are 18 of the tungsten foils and then 36 wafers arranged, as you say, one perpendicular to the other.
Mm-hmm. And how big is the entire object?
The part of it where we're talking about, the tracker, is about 600 millimeters, a couple feet.
Mm-hmm.
And there are additional detector below and a box around it, which we can talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So the transverse dimensions are about 5 feet by 5 feet.
Mm-hmm.
The vertical dimension's about 3 feet, and then underneath it is the satellite. The whole thing is about the size of a VW bus,
standing on end.
I
see. And I think you told me that this was the largest cubic array of silicon in the world?
I think it was at one point. It's probably been surpassed by now. There's almost 100 square yards of instrumented silicon in this thing.
Okay, so could you describe a little bit more about how you reconstruct what has happened with the gamma ray coming in by measuring the position of these of the electron and the positron?
It's basically a billiard ball problem. You have two outgoing particles. We sometimes actually know what the energy of each of those particles was, and I can actually describe how we do that. Below the tracker in this diagram, you see something called a calorimeter. And what that's composed of is a bunch of layers of bars of cesium iodide with photodiodes on the ends of them. And one of the properties of cesium iodide is when a charged particle goes through it, some of that energy is converted into light. And so by measuring the amount of light in these bars, we can tell how much energy there was in the particle that went through it. So in the ideal case now, we have an electron and a positron, and we know their energies. And so this is a simple physics problem to reconstruct the thing that was the cause of making these two particles. We can calculate its energy, which is basically the sum of the energies of the electron and positron, and its direction by using vector analysis and relativity and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Now, how often do you get a separate measurement of the energy of the electron and a separate measurement of the energy of the positron?
That happens at the very lowest energies. For higher energies, the electron and positron tracks get closer and closer together, and at a certain point, we can't tell which is which, and all of the energy blossoms out in the calorimeter, basically in one blob.
Mm-hmm.
But in that case, the electron and positron are essentially going in exactly the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
So we know what the direction of the gamma ray was because it's the same direction.
Right. So how accurately can you determine the direction of the incident gamma ray?
That depends on the energy of the gamma ray. And the reason it does is because the electron and positron undergo what's called multiple scattering in all of this tungsten. They get scattered around as they're going through.
Mm-hmm.
This multiple scattering is more pronounced at low energies and at higher energy. These things just punch through. So for a gamma ray of 1 GeV, or billion times an electron volt, we can measure the direction of the incident gamma ray to about a tenth of a degree.
A tenth of a degree?
Right.
Ah.
And at 100 million electron volts, it's more like a degree or a couple of degrees. And then at even higher energies, we actually do somewhat better. But eventually, we're limited by the fact that the strips are not continuous, and so the ultimate resolution is a few hundredths of a degree.
A few hundredths of a degree.
At the very highest energies.
And as you said, that's limited by the fact that you have 100 wires per inch as opposed to 1,000 or 10,000 wires.
Right. And that in turn is limited by the amount of power we're allowed to dissipate. The whole satellite runs on 600 watts.
Now, how many gamma rays do you see a second?
It depends to some extent on what you define as a gamma ray. The set of gamma rays that are the cleanest, we can get the best kind of information, and by relaxing that standard, we get more gamma rays with maybe perhaps some contamination. At the most relaxed standards, we measure about 4 gamma rays per second, and for the most refined set of what we call cuts, which is what we use for the most delicate measurements, 1 gamma ray every few seconds.
And how many other particles besides gamma rays do you see every second?
there are thousands of cosmic rays going through this detector every second, and we have to pick out the one or two events that are actually gamma rays and are not cosmic rays.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we do that, actually, is the third piece of this detector, which is called the anti-coincidence detector. And if you look at the diagram, it's the thing that's right under the yellow meteor shield, the thing that looks like a bunch of gray tiles. And these are also scintillators, and when a charged particle like a proton goes through the detector and makes a track in our tracker, we can point that track back and see if it would have gone through one of these tiles. And if that tile fired, that means that this particle was already charged by the time it got to our detector. So it couldn't be gamma ray.
These are labeled in the image as Vito counters.
Right.
So
right.
If the Vito counter shows you the passage of a charged particle, then you know that this was not a gamma ray coming in.
Right. And in order for this to work, since there are thousands mm-hmm. of these charged particles, these Vito counters have to be at least 99.97% efficient to detect charged particles. And they've been measured to be that efficient.
99.97%.
Right.
Is that hard to do?
You have to be careful. You have to make sure that you collect as much light as possible, that the light is uniform over the tiles, that the phototubes are sufficiently sensitive, that you don't lose too much light going from these tiles to the phototubes because they travel down long light pipes. It was a big deal, actually.
How accurately do you have to measure the time of each of these things occurring in order to not be confused between the last cosmic ray and the next gamma ray?
There was a previous satellite that was very successful, that sort of was the pioneer in this area, called the Cosmic Ray Gamma Observatory. And on that, there was a detector called EGRIT. That one had a dead time, that is the time it took between when you got an event and when you could see the next event, of milliseconds. And this doesn't seem like very much, but if they're coming in at several thousand per second, you can see that they're going to tend to crowd up. Our detector has a dead time on 10 to 20 microseconds, so that's almost 1,000 times better.
So that means if an event comes through, you can't see a second event for 10 to 20 millionths of a second.
Right.
But after that, then you'll be alive again.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Now, in fact, it turns out that sometimes you even can see, when you get an event, you can see the remnants of a previous event still kind of hanging around in the detector. And that's been an interesting little problem that we've been working on, and we think we understand how to deal with that now. But basically, we are live very high rates, and this 10 microseconds becomes important in two ways. One is that you want to be able to check to see if an event is a photon, and if it's not, be ready for the next one. But also, there are certain kinds of events where lots of photons come in a big burst. And for those, if you were dead for milliseconds, you'd actually be missing quite a few of those real gamma rays that are coming through.
Hmm. So if you get a gamma ray burst, how many gamma rays might you see?
You might see several hundred in a fraction of a second.
You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and today we're talking about the Gamma Ray Telescope with Dr. Leon Rochester. We'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's guidetothecosmos.com.
We're back talking about the Gamma Ray Space Telescope with Dr. Leon Rochester. So let's talk about how the satellite itself works. It's in orbit around the Earth. It's at about a 350-mile altitude above the Earth. So it has a 90-minute orbit. And you're saying that it looks at a very large area of the sky.
Satellite is pointed more or less outward. And at any given time, it sees a cone of about 45 or 50 degrees around the pointing of the satellite. So this is an extremely large area compared to most astronomical observatories. And this is on purpose because we are running this satellite in what's called survey mode. And that means that it's supposed to monitor the whole sky at a regular interval for the next 5 or 10 years. So if anything happens, we can observe it over the long term. It turns out that we can essentially see the whole sky every 2 orbits. And the reason we need 2 orbits is because if we just pointed straight out, we would see a wide band of the sky, but we wouldn't see the whole sky. So what we do is, in 1 orbit, we tilt the satellite by 40 degrees. On the next orbit, we tilt it 40 degrees the other way. And so the combination of those two means we can see the whole sky.
So the satellite is rotating back and forth between looking at the left and looking at the right as it's orbiting around the Earth.
Exactly.
Yeah, I see. So one of the purposes of the satellite is to look for these gamma ray bursts and to try to provide information to better understand what these creatures really are.
Right.
And these can be very short objects, as you described. The burst might only last a thousandth of a second. How long does it take between the time a gamma ray comes in and the time that you know where it came from?
Right. Well, we have on board, along with the Large Area Telescope, we have something called a Gamma Ray Burst Monitor. And this is a clever system of plates oscillator oriented at 90-degree axes. And when one of these bursts comes by, it's looking not at the gamma rays, which are relatively rare, but at the X-rays, which are much more plentiful. And by comparing the increase in counting rate in these 3 plates of scintillator, you can get a pretty good idea of where the burst came from, because if the burst is coming edge-on, you don't get many counts. If the burst is coming through the face, you get a lot of counts. And so by having these 3, you basically can figure out to within a pretty good estimate where this thing happened. The gamma ray burst monitor has a much wider field of view. So this thing is a companion instrument, and it's doing its own measurements. It's measuring a lot more bursts because it can take advantage of the X-rays, which are much more plentiful. When it sees a burst that looks like it might be interesting, it immediately signals to the satellite to reorient itself to point toward that burst. And so within maybe 30 seconds, we can be looking at this region of the sky where that burst came from. If we happen to be looking in that direction when the burst happened, we will detect all of the gamma rays that came from the start of the burst. If we weren't, then we will at least be able to pick up what's called the afterglow, which is all of the gamma ray radiation that comes anywhere from seconds to minutes to hours after the original gamma ray burst. And this is also extremely useful information. At the same time, the combination of the gamma ray burst detector and the Large Area Telescope can send a signal to the ground that generates a telegram to all the other astronomical observatories that are around, telescopes and other satellites and so on. And they can also move and look at that point in space and sort of understand what's going on in the optical, the X-rays, the radios, and so on. And we've actually done that on a number of occasions, and some of the papers we published have been in conjunction with other observatories.
How much of this is fully automated, and how much of this requires an astronomer to say, yeah, let's go do that?
The Fermi mission has the feature of being able to autonomously repoint. So if there's a burst detected above a certain level, it will automatically seek that out and follow it for something like, I think, 5 hours, and then return to the to the survey mode.
Mm-hmm. And the telegram that you send out to all the other astronomers across the world, is that the sending of that telegram is fully automated?
The sending is automated. Of course, somebody has to read it at the other end and do something about it. But people are very interested in being able to make these simultaneous measurements. So one of the things that these other observatories may have some automation of their own, or a very quick response with somebody who's prepared to be looking for these things coming through.
And what have we observed with this new technology?
There's a whole list of really cool things that have been seen. I don't know if you have the sky map up there.
Yeah, the sky map is image number 6 on the website.
This sky map is a summary of the rate of gamma rays coming from every point in the sky for over an entire year of data taking. And you can see there's lots and lots of structure there. The first obvious thing is that there's this big bright band horizontally across the center. And what we're looking at is our own galaxy, the Milky Way, where the plane of the Milky Way is at the equator. So the point in the middle of the picture is the center of our galaxy. And the point at the, say, at the right edge, where you see those three bright spots, is the anticenter. It's looking out away from the center of the galaxy. So you see the plane of the galaxy. You see lots and lots of sources along that plane. The three over on the right here are actually fairly famous, the Crab Nebula. One of them is the Vela Pulsar. And the third one is an object called Gamma, which is the first pulsar that was ever detected to pulse in gamma rays. And this was actually detected by EGRIT. Every other one of these bright spots is another source, most of which have actually been identified with known objects. Some of them are pulsars, some of them are active galactic nuclei. This is a galaxy where there's an infalling of matter into the massive black hole at the center of the galaxy.
That would be something that would be outside of our own galaxy.
That would be another galaxy outside of our own galaxy. And as the material falls into the black hole, it heats up and generates gamma rays. And so we can see these things shining brightly in the gamma rays. In addition, there is a sort of a diffuse haze. Some of them come from our own galaxy. Some of them come from outside. There's likely two sources. One is that high-energy cosmic rays striking the cosmic microwave background and the other light that's moving around produces high-energy gamma rays by kicking up the light to a higher energy. And also, this could also be due to millions and millions of individual point sources that are too far away for us to actually distinguish them. So this picture itself is extremely valuable. This is a very detailed map of the sky in gamma rays. In addition, as I said, we've been detecting these pulsars, these rapidly rotating neutron stars, many of which were actually discovered by us because they only pulse in gamma rays and don't pulse in radio waves where most of the other pulsars have been discovered. We've discovered gamma rays from nebula around pulsars. We've seen, as I said, gamma rays from active galactic nuclei. We have caught 9 of these gamma ray bursts in the act. That is, they happened and we were pointing to them. These are thought to be produced either by supernovas or by some really exotic stuff like the merging of black holes and neutron stars in binary systems. We've actually seen gamma rays from the sun and the moon.
Well, I could understand how gamma rays might come from the sun. It's, after all, a source of great energy. But how about the moon?
Right. Yes, it's a bit of a surprise until you think about it a bit. Mm. The reason the moon produces gamma rays is because it itself is being struck by high-energy cosmic rays. And if a cosmic ray hits the surface of the moon at a glancing angle and produces a gamma ray, that gamma ray will continue in the same direction, and then we will observe it. So it's producing gamma rays by virtue of its being a target.
So do you see the moon in terms of seeing the rim of the moon?
These gamma rays tend to be low energy, so the resolution isn't terrifically good. That sort of smears it out, but I believe you can see some structure there. We also can see gamma rays produced in the Earth's atmosphere. If you're in the satellite and you look out sideways, you will see the edge of the atmosphere. And the edge of the atmosphere functions in the same way to produce high-energy gamma rays from incoming cosmic rays. And in fact, we can use this so-called albedo signal to help to calibrate our detectors. We hope as we collect more data over the years, we may be able to distinguish a signal from dark matter. If the dark matter that composes 80% of the matter in the universe is of a certain type, we ought to be able to see evidence of it by its annihilation of a dark matter, anti-dark matter, into very energetic gamma rays.
What type of dark matter would produce this sort of signal?
This is weakly interacting massive particle, such as one of the supersymmetric particles. What you would need for this is a particle and its antiparticle getting close enough together to annihilate. You'd expect this would happen more often where the density of these objects is highest, and that would probably be the center of our galaxy or the center of nearby galaxy clusters. So that's where we're concentrating on. The essential feature of the theory is that there is a massive particle which doesn't decay into any other particles. They were made during the Big Bang, and they're still hanging around because they don't decay.
So these weakly interacting massive particles, which some people call WIMPs, would annihilate with an anti-WIMP.
Right.
Is there an energy that these gamma rays should have to match the theory?
Well, nobody knows what the mass of these WIMPs are. The energy of the gamma ray would be related to the energy of the WIMP. One of the things we're trying to look for is any deviation from a smooth curve when you plot the energy of the gamma rays versus the number of them. Typically, these things fall off exponentially, where we'd be looking for a slight bump somewhere, and if the bump were found from the energy of that bump, we would be able to infer the mass of the WIMP.
And all of the data that we're looking at now, that's just from the first year.
That's the first year.
Of data collection.
That's right.
And you're hoping that this satellite will last at least 10 years.
Right. The mission goal is 5 years. There's no reason for it to end at 5 years if it's still working.
Another image that we have on the website, image number 4, shows the Fermi gamma ray detector loaded inside the Delta II rocket waiting to be launched. Image number 5 shows the actual launch. You know, Leon, if I look at image number 4, I see a number of people standing around the Delta II rocket. Is one of those people you, Leon?
They never let me get within a mile of that place.
I see. They don't trust physicists to actually touch the gear, huh?
No.
Well, Leon, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. This was a great show, and you really had an awful lot to tell us about gamma rays. I love it.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it myself.
Okay, great. We look forward to there being more data in the future to talk about.
Great.
Thanks again, Leon.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. And remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.